For once, said Dr. Ferris. I agree with Mr. Kennan. I agree with his facts, if not with his feelings. You don't have to worry about the intellectuals, Wesley. Just put a few of them on the government payroll and send them out to preach precisely the sort of thing Mr. Kennan mentioned, that the blame rests on the victims. Give them moderately comfortable salaries and extremely loud titles, and they'll forget their copyrights and do a better job for you than whole squads of enforcement officers. Yes, said Mooch. I know. The danger that I'm worried about will come from a different quarter, said Dr. Ferris thoughtfully. You might run into quite a bit of trouble on that voluntary gift certificate business, Wesley.
I know, said Mooch glumly. That's the point I wanted Thompson to help us out on, but I guess he can't. We don't actually have the legal power to seize the patents. Oh, there's plenty of clauses in dozens of laws that can be stretched to cover it, almost, but not quite. Any tycoon who'd want to make a test case would have a very good chance to beat us, and we'd have to preserve a semblance of legality or the populace won't take it.
Precisely, said Dr. Ferris. It's extremely important to get those patents turned over to us voluntarily. Even if we had a law permitting outright nationalization, it would be much better to get them as a gift. We won't leave the people the illusion that they're still preserving their private property rights, and most of them will play along. They'll sign the gift certificates. Just raise a lot of noise about its being a patriotic duty and that anyone who refuses is a prince of greed, and they'll sign. But, he stopped.
I know, said Mooch.
He was growing visibly more nervous.
There will be, I think, a few old-fashioned bastards here and there who'll refuse to sign. But they won't be prominent enough to make a noise. Nobody will hear about it. Their own communities and friends will turn against them for their being selfish, so it won't give us any trouble. We'll just take the patents over anyway, and those guys won't have the nerve or the money to start a test case.
But he stopped. James Taggart leaned back in his chair, watching them. He was beginning to enjoy the conversation.
Yes, said Dr. Ferris. I'm thinking of it, too. I'm thinking of a certain tycoon who is in a position to blast us to pieces. Whether we'll recover the pieces or not is hard to tell. God knows what is liable to happen at a hysterical time like the present, and in a situation as delicate as this. Anything can throw everything off balance. Blow up the whole works. And if there's anyone who wants to do it, he does. He does and can. He knows the real issue. He knows things which must not be said, and he is not afraid to say them. He knows the one dangerous, fatally dangerous weapon. He is our deadliest adversary.
Who? Asked Lawson. Dr. Ferris hesitated, shrugged, and answered,
The guiltless man.
Lawson stared blankly.
What do you mean? And whom are you talking about?
James Taggart smiled.
I mean that there is no way to disarm any man, said Dr. Ferris, except through guilt, through that which he himself has accepted as guilt. If a man has ever stolen a dime, you can impose on him the punishment intended for a bank robber, and he will take it. He'll bear any form of misery. He'll feel that he deserves no better. If there's not enough guilt in the world, we must create it. If we teach a man that it's evil to look at spring flowers, and he believes us, and then does it, we'll be able to do whatever we please with him. He won't defend himself. He won't feel he's worth it. He won't fight. But save us from the man who lives up to his own standards. Save us from the man of clean conscience. He's the man who'll beat us.
Are you talking about Henry Reardon?
Asked Taggart, his voice peculiarly clear. The one name they had not wanted to pronounce struck them into an instant silence.
What if I were? Asked Dr. Ferris cautiously.
Oh, nothing, said Taggart. Only if you were, I would tell you that I can deliver Henry Reardon. He'll sign.
By the rules of their unspoken language, they all knew, from the tone of his voice, that he was not bluffing.
God, Jim! No! Gasped Wesley Mooch.
Yes, said Taggart. I was stunned, too, when I learned what I learned. I didn't expect that. Anything but that.
I am glad to hear it, said Mooch cautiously. It's a constructive piece of information. It might be very valuable indeed.
Valuable? Yes, said Taggart pleasantly. When do you plan to put the directive into effect?
Oh, we'll have to move fast. We don't want any news of it to leak out. I expect you all to keep this most strictly confidential. I'd say that we'll be ready to spring it on them in a couple of weeks.
Don't you think it would be advisable, before all prices were frozen, to adjust the matter of the railroad rates? I was thinking of a raise, a small but most essentially needed raise.
We'll discuss it, you and I, said Mooch amiably. It might be arranged.
He turned to the others. Boyle's face was sagging. There are many details still to be worked out, but I'm sure that our program won't encounter any major difficulties.
He was assuming the tone and manner of a public address. He sounded brisk and almost cheerful. Rough spots are to be expected. If one thing doesn't work, we'll try another. Trial and error is the only pragmatic rule of action. We'll just keep on trying. If any hardships come up, remember that it's only temporary, only for the duration of the national emergency.
Say, asked Kennan, how is the emergency to end if everything is to stand still?
Don't be theoretical, said Mooch impatiently. We've got to deal with the situation of the moment. Don't bother about minor details, so long as the broad outlines of our policy are clear. We'll have the power. We'll be able to solve any problem and answer any question.
Fred Kennan chuckled.
Who is John Galt?
Don't say that, cried Taggart.
I've a question to ask about point 7, said Kennan. It says that all wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, and so forth will be frozen on the date of the directive. Taxes, too?
Oh, no, cried Mooch. How can we tell what funds we'll need in the future?
Kennan seemed to be smiling.
Well, snapped Mooch, what about it?
Nothing, said Kennan. I just asked.
Mooch leaned back in his chair. I must say to all of you that I appreciate your coming here and giving us the benefit of your opinions. It has been very helpful. He leaned forward to look at his desk calendar and sat over it for a moment, toying with his pencil. Then the pencil came down, struck a date, and drew a circle around it. Directive 10-289 will go into effect on the morning of May 1st. All nodded approval. None looked at his neighbor. James Taggart rose, walked to the window, and pulled the blind down over the white obelisk. In the first moment of awakening, Dagny was astonished to find herself looking at the spires of unfamiliar buildings against a glowing pale blue sky. Then she saw the twisted seam of the thin stocking on her own leg. She felt a wrench of discomfort in the muscles of her waistline. And she realized that she was lying on the couch in her office, with the clock on her desk saying 6:15, and the first rays of the sun giving silver edges to the silhouettes of the skyscrapers beyond the window. The last thing she remembered was that she had dropped down on the couch, intending to rest for 10 minutes, when the window was black and the clock stood at 3:30. She twisted herself to her feet, feeling an enormous exhaustion. The lighted lamp on the desk looked futile in the glow of the morning, over the piles of papers which were her cheerless, unfinished task. She tried not to think of the work for a few minutes longer, while she dragged herself past the desk to her washroom and let handfuls of cold water run over her face. The exhaustion was gone by the time she stepped back into the office. No matter what night preceded it, she had never known a morning when she did not feel the rise of a quiet excitement that became a tightening energy in her body and a hunger for action in her mind. Because this was the beginning of day, and it was a day of her life. She looked down at the city. The streets were still empty. It made them look wider, and in the luminous cleanliness of the spring air, they seemed to be waiting for the promise of all the greatness that would take form in the activity about to pour through them. The calendar in the distance said, May 1st. She sat down at her desk, smiling in defiance at the distastefulness of her job. She hated the reports that she had to finish reading, but it was her job. It was her railroad. It was morning. She lighted a cigarette, thinking that she would finish this task before breakfast. She turned off the lamp and pulled the papers forward. There were reports from the general managers of the four regions of the Taggart system, their pages a typewritten cry of despair over the breakdowns of equipment. There was a report about a wreck on the main line near Winston, Colorado. There was the new budget of the operating department, the revised budget, based on the raise in rates which Jim had obtained last week. She tried to choke the exasperation of hopelessness as she went slowly over the budget's figures. All those calculations had been made on the assumption that the volume of freight would remain unchanged, and that the raise would bring them added revenue by the end of the year. She knew that the freight tonnage would go on shrinking, that the raise would make little difference, that by the end of this year their losses would be greater than ever.